KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Why do Cuban elementary school children score higher, much higher, in math and language tests than the children in other Latin American countries? That's the question Martin Carnoy set out to answer, and his conclusions are relevant to U.S. education. He joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. From KQED, we're talking this hour with Martin Carnoy, and we're talking about Cuba and elementary education there. Despite economic impoverishment and lack of political freedom, Cuban elementary school children score higher in math and language tests than children in other Latin American countries. And Martin Carnoy is a Stanford professor of education and economics who undertook a research project to find out the reason for this higher achievement among Cuban children. And he learned a good deal himself in the process applicable to U.S. education. He's the author of All Else Equal, Are Private and Public Schools Different? Sustaining the New Economy, Work, Family, and Community in the Information Age, and a book called Faded Dreams, The Economics of Politics and Race in America. His latest book is called Cuba's Academic Achievement, Why Students in Cuba Do Better in School, and he joins us, and good to see you again. Welcome.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Well, they do better all across the board, even in rural areas, and better than middle-class kids from the rest of Latin America, and yet they do better in spite of the fact that these aren't supposed to be, hierarchy and bureaucracy are not supposed to be tantamount to good education or better results in education, but in Cuba they are.
Well, I think that the Cubans suggest, the Cuban system suggests that at least for lower and lower middle income kids, bureaucracy and hierarchy actually works pretty well. In fact, you could argue, well, it's a fairly efficient, in terms of education, it's a pretty efficient bureaucracy. I mean, that's important to point out. I mean, inefficient bureaucracy is a killer, but efficient bureaucracy, as we know, like the social security system, is a good thing.
And this is a pretty high quality of teachers, too. But as you point out in your book, higher expectations for the student, better management overall, really.
Absolutely. And the teachers are extremely well trained, and it's highly focused in terms of what their training is about. The whole system is organized around instruction. Instruction is the absolute end all of this system. So teachers are taught to be good instructors around a curriculum that's clearly defined, and then they are supervised to make sure that they deliver that curriculum as it's supposed to be delivered.
And are we judging not only by test results here, we're judging by, I mean, you did a lot of videotaping and you did a lot of interviewing and so forth, went to particularly Brazil and Chile by contrast. You know?
Right. I think the difference with this between this study and other studies that have been done on Cuban education, and I did one back in the early 80s, is that we actually had measurements this time. We had the test scores from a UNESCO test that was applied in 1987 to 13 Latin American countries. And we had, in addition, so we followed up on that, and we went in and videotaped classrooms in the three countries, Cuba, Brazil, and Chile. And the videotapes were just fascinating. These were of math lessons in the third grade. And we expect on videotapes the teachers are going to perform to the best of their ability, and we want them to. But in watching these videotapes, and we quantified what the teachers were doing, we went through these rubrics to see how much time they were spending doing different things, and in addition, the content level of what they were teaching. And the differences are really...
They're pretty dramatic, aren't
pretty
they?
Pretty dramatic.
Yeah. This is really a child-centered approach. This is a kind of no child left behind in the real sense of that phrase.
Absolutely. It's a totally child-centered approach. And from both from a philosophical standpoint and also that the entire Cuban society is to some extent organized around benefiting kids and not benefiting adults so much, but benefiting kids. And it's very interesting what happens when you do that. They live in a essentially violence-free society. There's no evidence from the UNESCO survey that there's any violence in Cuban classrooms to speak of in comparison with other Latin American classrooms.
Or American classrooms. So the schools are safe.
Schools are safe. The kids have their guaranteed meals if they want them. A lot of them go home for meals, but they have them at school if they want to take them there. And they're at school all day long. They're not in classes all day long. The class time is about the same as in other Latin American schools, and pretty much like it's a little shorter than in American schools. But they're there in the afternoon as well. And the interesting thing is, like in the Italian system, like Montessori, they're with the same teacher from 4 years in elementary school. Now it's being extended to 6 years. Now you say, oh boy, what if we have a bad teacher and this kid is with a bad teacher for the whole time? But the difference is that there is more of a guarantee that the teacher is not going to be bad. The parents do have an option of complaining and saying, I don't want that teacher. But the fact is that the teachers know every one of these kids so, so well because they have them for a long time.
There's always that ethos in education that it's good to be exposed to different kinds of teachers to get a different range of teaching and pedagogy.
Well,
you know?
Maybe. But on the other hand, the objective of this system is to make sure that no kid falls between the cracks. So if that's your objective, then you could argue that it's better to have one teacher, particularly in primary school.
This goes against a lot of conventionalism. For example, the size of classrooms.
Well, when they did this test, they had 35 kids in the class. That was in the late 90s. Since then, and much more successfully than in California, they moved from 35 to 20 kids. Now, what they did was, unlike California, first they mobilized for 6 months the entire society to build more classrooms. And then they went down to 20 kids in the classroom. They had to produce a lot more teachers in order to do that at the elementary level.
Talking to Martin Carnoy, a professor of economics and education at Stanford, has written a book called Cuba's Academic Advantage, Why Students in Cuba Do Better in Schools, both a micro and a macro study. And as I said earlier, there's a lot of comparison to Chile and Brazil, but there's also comparison here to most of the Latin American nations, and Cuba really excels far beyond there. What are we to learn from this in our own U.S. educational system?
Well, I think there's some things that are transferable easily, and there are other things that aren't so easily transferable. The easy things to transfer is this idea of focus on instruction. I think we're moving toward that. But in Cuba, it goes down to every school. It's highly supervised, and it's supervised mainly by the principals and vice principals in the schools. They have a very close connection with the parents. I think that's another thing that you can learn. Their teacher training, their teacher education is much more controlled directly by the government. That is, the government makes sure that the teachers are trained to teach the way the standards have been set up. And the standards are high. That's another issue. And expectations are high. I think we can learn from that. I think we can learn from focus on better teaching, control of the teaching, supervision of the teaching, making sure that elementary school kids are very carefully monitored, actually what they are learning. And all these things are transferable.
The skeptic might say to be little automatons of the communist state or something along those lines. I'm sure you've probably heard that sort of rhetoric, haven't you?
Sure. Well, it doesn't have to be a communist state. Singapore does the same thing. Korea pretty much does the same thing. Now, these are authoritarian states, it's true. But on the other hand, if you really want kids all the way down to your lower-income kids to be learning well, somebody has to be responsible for that. And I think that most people would agree that that this is something you might actually want, not where Big Brother's telling you what to do, but at least that the government in delivering education is efficient and equitable in doing it. So that's, I think we can learn that. What's harder to transfer is this, is the quality of the teachers themselves and how much knowledge they have. In Cuba, everybody's paid pretty much the same. All professionals are paid about the same. So whether you become a teacher or a psychiatrist doesn't really make much difference in terms of your salary. So to become a teacher does not require, as in California, to give up a lot of salary rather than becoming a lawyer. So they get pretty good people going into teaching. It's a little harder to transfer, but we're a society that has a lot more resources than Cuba, so we could afford to pay our school personnel a lot more if we really wanted to.
Chris, here's one of the concerns, in fact, that was raised by our executive producer, Raul Ramirez, who is originally from Cuba, and he was talking about how, because you're looking at third grade largely in your in your own empirical study, and he was talking about how kids will show in Cuban public schools and their elementary schools real talent for, let's say, technology or for science or for literature or whatever it may be, but they'll be geared toward another occupation. I mean, in effect, the state has a lot to do with midwifing what occupation they go into, and so it doesn't necessarily isn't necessarily consonant with whatever their talents might be.
Absolutely. As I said to start with, it's a society that focuses a lot more on bringing the kids up to a high level of achievement and attainment, but doesn't take care of its adults very well in terms of what choices it gives them and in terms of other aspects of the society. So it raises some very interesting issues about what it really takes to have a great education system for everybody. I think that other societies have quite good education systems for their upper middle class kids, and the question is what happens in the bottom half.
We're talking again with Martin Carnoy. His new book is called Cuba's Academic Advantage. There's also this kind of X factor, big X factor of social capital, the importance of relationships of family and community that you go into some detail on. And again, there may be a great deal for us to learn from that because the social context is really preeminent in its importance and really provides a tremendous kind of symbiosis between what goes on in the schools.
Well, it's a little harder to transfer, I would say. But, you know, a very interesting example in the U.S. are the Defense Department schools on military bases. There are about 150 Defense Department schools around the world, about 60 of them, 50 or 60 in the United States. So the kids that go to these schools, if you look at the data from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, they separate them out. And what's really interesting is how much better the black and Hispanic kids do in those schools compared to typical public school in the rest of the U.S. Now, one of the reasons that they probably do better in those schools is that they have the entire social support system of the military, which includes guaranteed health care. It's basically a state-run system, the military. So the kids are supported that way. The teachers hired are slightly more qualified and slightly better paid than in the rest of the system. But the most important thing, I think, is this tremendously controlled environment for the kids. And the fact is that if parents don't show up for a parent conference, I think the teacher would probably call the captain and point that out. And the captain would probably call in the parent and say, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? You know, so, I mean, that gives you an idea. And the results are clear.
Catholic schools, too, to a great degree. Well, lesser degree than defense, obviously. But yeah.
It's very unclear in the Catholic schools because at least when these things were measured back in the 80s and 90s, the percentage of low-income black kids that were of the total of low-income black kids that were attending these schools was so small that it's hard to say whether they were at all comparable with the rest. But the kids in the military school, there might be a selection problem there, too. But remember that basically you need a high school degree to go into the military, and there's some slippage on that now, too, with the recruitment problems. So I think you're getting pretty typical parents of the kids, fairly representative of the parents that are outside the military. So I think the kids that are getting these higher scores look like the kids that are in these urban schools, but they're in a different environment.
also have, in the military, I think, standards of what good teaching is, and they certainly do in the Cuban schools as well, as opposed to these Latin American schools. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot more. There's a lot more control in the military environment, and again, I think it's a really interesting question of how much Americans really want to have a totally free choice society versus a society where certain things are actually available to them and available in such a way that it's high quality and you don't have a choice. That would be I'm putting it the best light.
No, but it's a good way to put it. It's like, you know, you're talking about violence-free society. A lot of people would be willing to give up civil liberties to have Big Brother or the state control things so that they wouldn't have the fear of violence, perhaps. Or
well, they certainly don't want violence in the schools. I mean, the parents, I think this is, for many parents, the number one issue. In fact, you mentioned Catholic schools. I think if you ask parents why they're sending their kids to these Catholic schools, many of them non-Catholics, they want a violence-free environment. They want a more controlled environment for their kids.
Which is what they have in Cuba. They also have more, you point out, more coherent curricula in Cuban schools.
Yeah, they focus on...
And that's against control. That's state control.
Well, it's also... No, it's more general. It's a European curriculum. So it's fewer subjects, but better, but deeper understanding of the subject. I think even in the primary school, if you look at the Cuban textbook, which they hardly use in the classroom, but as elsewhere, you very rarely see textbooks in any of these classrooms. But if you look at a Brazilian textbook, it covers many more subjects than the Cuban textbook. But how many teachers are actually covering those subjects is another issue, and how well they cover them. Typical American textbook covers lots of subjects. There's been a lot of literature on this, sort of a mile wide and an inch deep, as it was called in the literature. While the Cuban curriculum is East German curriculum translated into Spanish. I mean, in math, that's for sure. And it's a typical European curriculum. We're going to take these subjects. Every kid is going to learn it absolutely. And they're going to also learn it in math. They really understand the math. That's the idea.
And it's more advanced than the other Latin American countries.
Yeah. They teach it with more understanding. You can see it in the videotapes. It isn't just the operations of the math.
Did you have any problems? I mean, you were doing this research project at a time when there isn't great accessibility to Cuba.
Still not.
What did you have to...
Oh, that was a pretty interesting story. I thought it would be pretty easy to get in there and just videotape. I was naive, actually, about it. We finished our work in Brazil and Chile just quickly. And then I started to try to get into Cuba and actually do this. It was pretty difficult. By chance, I was in Santiago, and the Minister of Education there knew that I was interested in doing this in Cuba as well. And so I came in there, and she said, you know, the Minister of Education is actually staying in your hotel at this moment, so I'll arrange a meeting with him. And so he met with me for an hour and sort of cleared me politically. And then after that, everything just happened very quickly.
No static from your own government about doing this project?
No, it's a very little known. I mean, academics and all kinds of people can go to Cuba. The restriction is not on going to Cuba. The restriction is on spending money in Cuba.
Yeah.
And so if you have academic reasons or a journalist, the Treasury will give you a pass. You just go to Miami and get your visa.
So you spent more time in Cuba than you did in Brazil and Chile, actually?
About the same.
Again, we're talking to Martin Carnoy. His book is Cuba's Academic Advantage, Why Students in Cuba Schools Do Better. I learned a lot about James Coleman, a sociologist that I didn't know much about, in fact, knew nothing about really before I read your book. A very important figure in terms of American education.
Absolutely. And, he did a monumental study in the mid-60s looking at the relationship between, this was during the period of just the beginning of desegregation. And so... he did a study trying to see whether kids that went to schools that were mixed race schools were better off than kids that did not. And in order to do that, he had to do a big survey of schools, and he tried to see what the effect of schooling was versus the effect of social class. Now, there were a lot of problems with that study statistically, but nevertheless, it kicked off a whole era of doing these kinds of studies, which still continues with more sophisticated statistical techniques and better data. But the fact is that the idea was hatched in the mid-60s. And later on, in the early 80s, he did another monumental study comparing Catholic schools with the public schools and seeing whether Catholic schools had a more positive effect. These were high schools. There was a lot of controversy about that one, too, but even so, it kicked off another era of doing these kinds of comparison studies, which still continues today. And so, then finally did the social capital. He introduced this idea of – he has a particular view of social capital. We discuss that in the book. It's very individualized around the family.
This sense, again, of the family and the community and the expectations of students is so key here. I'm just wondering if other Latin American countries have been perhaps inclined now, especially with Brazil turning more socialist in your studies, Brazil and Chile, by contrast, are they more inclined to follow a kind of Cuban paradigm? Or is that?
No, in fact, it's really complicated. Chile's a more interesting case. Brazil is highly decentralized, and despite the fact that maybe Lula might be the president and it's introducing some aspects of socialism, which such as, well, I wouldn't call it even socialism, that basically giving income, guaranteed income to very low-income people. They send them a check every month. We experimented with that during the Nixon administration. The system is highly autonomous and decentralized. In fact, at the primary level in Brazil, you have municipal systems alongside state systems, states like California. And you may have in the same block a municipal primary school and a state primary school run by two different administrations. So it's pretty, I would say, it is very decentralized system and very little control over what goes on. But Chile's interesting because Chile's this famous voucher experiment where you have all these 46% of kids go to 47% maybe go to private schools. Most, about 75% of them or 80% of them are subsidized private school. They get exactly the same amount of money as a municipal school per kid. And so ostensibly they're highly decentralized. Each school or municipality is making its own decisions about what to do. In fact, Chile does have a highly centralized curriculum and also lots of control in the system, and they're going back and forth on what they want to do with that.
And we're going to a break shortly here, but I want to invite those of you listening to join us. Martin Carnoy, our guest, and he raises the very central questions in his book, How Responsible Should Governments Be for Creating Environments That Help Children Focus on Academic Achievement? How much autonomy should teachers and schools have over what goes on in classrooms? Is there a trade-off between the value that market societies place on individual choice and on the value they place on ensuring that all children, regardless of socioeconomic background, receive high-quality schooling? You can join us, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free for your calls, 866-733-6786. We welcome them, and we welcome your emails. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Stanford professor Martin Carnoy, who has written a book called Cuba's Academic Advantage, and the subtitle is Why Students in Cuba Do Better in School, and you are welcome to join us in this conversation. Our toll-free number for your calls, again, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us with a question or a comment. We welcome your emails as well. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, and we're going to go to your calls and emails forthwith. Just talking to Professor Carnoy a little bit off air, though, about, the whole important lessons to glean, I suppose, here in the United States as one looks comparatively at any other educational system, and particularly at the Cuban system, which has had and continues to have a good deal of success in spite of the lack of political freedom and the problems with individual rights, human rights as well. But Martin Carney was saying off air that we just saw some new data, which is really kind of fascinating in many ways. No surprise in this data, but like you said, good to see the data about social class and education.
Yeah, I saw the data recently that if you look at, if you divide by high, middle, and low tests and math test scores of high school students versus their social class in terms of their parents' education, income, et cetera, you find that the high-scoring, low social class kids are about as likely to go to college as the low-scoring, high social class kids. So we were discussing, as this is in the context of choice, the fact is that we're a choice-oriented society. There's no question about it. We like individual rights. We like our individual freedom. But the interesting thing about this is, in terms of schooling, which is a complicated process and requires a tremendous amount of knowledge about what's going on and a lot of experience. Parents with more experience with these choices obviously can strategize much better with their kids. With all that, the question is, what are the choices that people have? How constrained are choices really for particular groups of kids? Are we losing an enormous amount of talent out there because we, instead of having a system, in fact, which helps direct these kids, I mean, really intervenes in their lives to point them in particular directions? How much are we losing as a result of that?
Well, we're a choice society, but we're also, we like to think of ourselves as an egalitarian society.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's all this notion, I keep thinking about reformers like Jonathan Kozol, you know, who have been trying to bring some level playing field here, and that's it's very difficult. I mean, when you look at the data, imagine what you see is the upper tiers, the upper social classes, obviously do better education.
No matter how talented they are or not talented they are.
Yeah. Well, let me go to your calls here, and we'll begin with a caller from Sacramento. Luis, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm a medical student here at UC Davis, and I'm an immigrant to the U.S., from Mexico. When I came, I was being taught decimal points on sixth grade. When in fifth grade in Mexico, I was starting to do square roots and algebra. Another point I would like to make is that I was fortunate to be in a school system here in California, in Santa Barbara particularly, where it was sort of a rich area that was supported by, you know, high taxes. So there was a lot of money to go around. And my question is, what are some of the first steps that we can take to make education more accessible? I know that most of our educational system is funded through local taxes, and whether having a more centralized, federally funded education system would better serve people like myself, people who are not from a high-income sort of background, to reach an educational level that is professional. And I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Martin Carney.
Well, in California, it's taxes, except for about 50, 60 school districts, taxes are all given to the, all the property taxes are given to the state and then sent back to the districts, and we augment the property taxes with income taxes. And theoretically, we're what's called a Serrano state from a decision in 1967, where spending is equalized across districts. The problem is that, as been shown, with that equal spending doesn't mean that you get equal education, because, of course, the better teachers and the better resources filter to the better districts, better meaning the kids, higher social class districts. In addition to that, of course, higher social class districts have their foundations and they raise extra money, et cetera. So it's very hard to even legislate equality. I think that the tack that has to be taken in addition to this is that the pool of quality teachers has to be large enough and deep enough that you also have very, very good teachers going into the lower income districts, even if we have to pay them bonuses and subsidies. I think obviously social class plays a huge role in determining how well kids do in school. But on the other hand, the way we structure our educational system is that less resources, even if you equalize the spending, go to the lower income kids. And this is the thing that has to be offset. And you could even argue that the better resources would have actually a bigger effect in the lower income schools, because in the higher income schools, kids have their parents in addition to the teachers. But in the lower income schools, they don't. And so if we really were after improving the situation for lower income kids, we should overcompensate there, where I think the payoff would be higher.
And let me thank you for your call, Luis. And on we go to more calls. Up in Hillsburg, Miles, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. Good to talk to you again. Great program. My question proceeds from what I feel is really the basic reality for California kids, and that is that they are so distracted from age two on by all kinds of anti-schooling, anti-intellectual activity, particularly television and electronic games, that they're simply turned away from all of the values that schools are trying to teach very early on. And I'm wondering if Mr. Carnoy has found that kids in other societies that he's looked at are as badly distracted as young Americans are.
Yeah, I think they are, actually. But I think we should, you know, being the father of a teenage daughter, I understand exactly what you're saying. But on the other hand, I think there's a difference for children growing up in upper middle class families where the emphasis is still huge. Maybe it's not so intellectual, but it's certainly on getting good grades and doing well in school. I mean, I would say there's even more pressure now than 20 years ago or even when I went to school to really do much, to just excel in school, because there's so much more competition for the places in these better colleges. So I think there's distraction and there's also more pressure. I think the question is, what is happening to, you know, the bottom 50% of kids? Now, in California, we have a really serious problem because the demographics of our state are such that we're going to have to begin producing a lot more college graduates out of lower-income populations, particularly Hispanic populations, where we're doing a terrible job of getting these kids to go to college and helping them to go to college.
One of the things that served that, of course, was the community colleges, which have been cut back so much in revenue now in terms of the ability to make it affordable for these people, for these young people, that the problem becomes, I think, aggrandized much more than we had imagined it could be, just due, again, to lack of resources and lack of the ability to afford even a community college education.
Well, what's even worse is what happens is that because of the lack of resources, the kids keep streaming into the community college and the state colleges, but the courses are not available. So they, in fact, take a long time to finish if they have the discipline to stay in there and the tenacity to hang in there. So it's not easy. But the fact is that a lot of them aren't going even to the state colleges or the four-year colleges. And if we don't start thinking about what it's going to take in order to do that, and that's where I think we can learn something from the Cubans, that it can be done. It can be done, but you're going to have to sort of reorient the system and reorient our thinking about how we talk about education.
Let me thank the caller. Here are some emails relevant to the Cuban system. Alex writes, do you think the lack of media advertising affects the tendency of Cuban children's likelihood to value education?
The lack of media?
They don't get blitzed with advertising, and particularly to buy all these things on kids programs that we see in advertising, and therefore...
Well, there's nothing to buy,
right?
Unless you happen to be working in the hotels.
But it's an interesting question. In other words, does it make them value education more because they don't have all that Madison Avenue crap floating into their life?
Well, I think the Cuban government would argue that they are, by dematerializing the society, they're actually promoting more human development and and more emphasis on education. They would make that argument. I think that that alone would not have really do it. They just put a lot of resources into the system, and it's a relatively poor society.
There's another listener, though, who raises a question probably that we certainly find this question being asked a lot more in Miami maybe than in San Francisco, but this is Phil who says, what good does it do for a child to have a great education when there's no incentive to be educated and everybody gets paid the same? This is oppression.
Well, it's a good question because, in fact, you can argue why would these kids be incentivized to do well in school and go far in school if really they end up in jobs which aren't very productive, et cetera. Well, it's a question that's being asked in Cuba, too, by the way. And I think there's no real answer to it, except, strangely enough, there still seems to be a fight to get into the better schools, to get into the universities. Kids do want to do well in school because they're being promoted from all sides to get a good education for themselves. I mean, this is important. You can ask yourself what it is that motivates anybody to really stay in school for 12 or 16 years. It's not the greatest experience for a kid to be doing well in school. I don't think young kids really understand that you're going to make a lot more money if you stay in school, et cetera. I think they get the idea that this is really important to their family, that this is a really important thing. And by the time they reach high school, most of these upper middle class kids have been totally internalized the idea that they're going to go to college and they're going to succeed academically.
That's a value system. And yet, by contrast, I mean, in the United States, you know, people are looking competitively, I used to joke and say, at the APGAR test. They start with the competition, but, you know, certainly kindergarten and thinking about getting in the best preschool and best Ivy League school and so forth and so on. I mean, with the idea in mind, and it may be a naive idea given that liberal education doesn't necessarily lead to a passport to a job anymore, but the idea that it's going to enhance the future, that it's going to bring about more compensation and a better living and so forth, and you'll do better than we did is what most parents want.
In Cuba, the idea is pushed that it will help the country. If you get more education, it's going to help Cuba.
We'll go to more calls here. And by the way, if you'd like to call us, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786 if you want to join the program. You can also do that by email again, and the email address is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. Carolyn, you're on with us. Good morning.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I was one of those kids educated many long years ago on the European model, and when I did come to the United States, I found that I was in many ways light years ahead of the other kids in my class, and especially at that point in time, girls. And some of that playing field has changed. As a parent, I walked in thinking public schools would be great and ended up, for the most part, educating my sons in private schools because I couldn't get the education that I needed. I had one child that was a gifted student, couldn't find programs and that kind of thing. But now, as a grandmother, I had raised a grandchild for the last 4.5 years, and we put her in public school here in Pacifica, and there is an alternative called Ocean Shore School, and it works very much on a private school model in that parents are required to spend at least 95 hours per child donating their time, effort, and energies to the school. And what I see that doing is it keeps children, whether it's your child or anybody else's, aware that this is a good thing. Education is a good thing, and they are being loved and supported by it. And it's much more the community model. And in looking at that, Pacifica is not a rich community at all. I mean, we've got some in the neighborhood that are very, very wealthy demographically, where we're much more mid-range. And these kids coming out of this school are so in love with learning and encouraged to keep on doing that. I think that it could be a model that would work in other districts, and I would like to hear comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Martin Carnoy.
Well, that, you know, that is our idea of the democratic model of making good schools. There were lots of ideas back in the 60s about having community-based schools exactly the way the caller described. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's a great idea. If the community has the organization, the wherewithal, and the time to do that and the motivation to do that, it's going to work well. There's no doubt about it. The question is really what happens in communities where both parents are working full-time and they're stressed out, they're low income, and there's a lot of violence in the community, et cetera. Who should be responsible? Now, you could argue the community should be responsible, the family should be responsible, but let's say that they're not. Let's say you can't get that organized there. Then the question is, for the society's sake, should there be another player that is responsible? Who is the default player here? And I think that the lesson that we can take from a well-organized education system is that the default player has to be the state government in the United States. It has to be the state government. Someone has to pick up the reins to get the cart to go. It's great if the community picks it up. It's great if the family picks it up. That would be ideal. But apparently lots of communities and lots of parents aren't doing it. So then the question is, what happens then?
Well, you indicate early on in your book that there's been a kind of attitudinal change about the view or with the view toward education here in the United States. In other words, the idea of blaming of the schools and the insistence on the schools teaching what the students need to learn has become pretty much pervasive.
Yeah, I think it's been pervasive for a long time. But now, with the increased competition, the stakes are so much higher. In the old days, if you didn't finish my generation, if you didn't finish high school, you still could get a good job in manufacturing and earn a really middle-class salary. That's not true anymore. Today's service jobs require a lot more education or a lot more educated people around. What is really worrisome is that there is an alternative. We could import all our educated labor and have a two-tier society with imported higher educated labor and local uneducated labor. I don't think that would be a very optimal solution.
Parts of Southern California where it almost seems to operate like that.
Well, it's in the long run, it's not a happy situation.
Todd is joining us from East Palo Alto. Morning, Todd.
Good morning. My question really is about potential misapplication of lessons from Cuba, and primarily, is control the best option? And particularly when you're talking about poor children in poorer communities, it gets translated as a scripted textbook education. And I guess what I'm wondering is there an appropriate sequence of reform? And in the Cuba model, there's mentioning of salaries relative to other professions being equal. I was intrigued by the multi-year instructional cycle. There's very powerful teacher education programs. And also, I think it's very fascinating that they don't use textbooks in their classroom, although they may exist. So isn't it something where we need to look at doing things in the right order, just like Cuba ramped up for class size reduction, unlike California? Is scripted education, particularly as it's done in a very fascist way here, the best solution, and should not groundwork be laid first before that we proceed to that?
I agree. I don't think the Cuban classrooms are scripted education. I think they're real child-centered education oriented to understanding. We just looked at math classrooms, but to understanding the math and actually understanding what the math means. They do a lot of problem sets. It's a paper poor society, but somehow in every class we saw sheets being handed out, the kids doing some problems, then discussing the problems with the teacher in a class-wide discussion. So I think it's just the opposite of scripted education. So I agree with you that if we should really look at the true lessons of the Cuban model and not and not just say, oh, we need more control. That really isn't the primary lesson learned.
Maybe we need more balance or more harmony or something like that. But thanks, Todd, for your call. I want to go to some of your emails here. This is from a listener says, please ask Professor Carnoy if there is corporal punishment or intimidation used by teachers in Cuba. I have heard from a friend that it is on occasion used, such as when students do not turn in homework.
Well, we certainly didn't see any, so I can't.
They were on their best behavior for you.
But, you know, I saw a film in Mali where the teacher was hitting a video of a class in Mali where the teacher was not at all shy about hitting kids in front of the camera. So I have to say that the way Cuban teachers are taught to teach is based on Vygotsky and Makarenko, which are very sort of child-centered type of philosophies of teacher education. And in fact, the teacher in a primary school in Cuba is a sort of pseudo-parent. They're with the kids pretty much 8 hours a day.
This is quite a relationship, as you say, over 4 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the way the teachers talk about the kids is exactly as if they were the parents. I have to point out one other thing, Michael, is very important, and that is that kids don't move around much between schools in Cuba because it's very hard to change apartments. In Cuba, there's no space to live, and people are assigned apartments, and that's it. So there's very little inter-school mobility. And for lower-income kids, I think this is a hugely positive thing. They stay basically in the same school. In the United States, we have 25% turnover rates per year, statewide in some states. In urban school districts, they're even higher than that. Kids are just moving from school to school. It's very hard to keep track of kids if they're changing schools every couple of years. In Cuba, that doesn't happen. And I think it has a positive effect. There have been a number of studies done that show that for lower socioeconomic class kids, lots of school changes are very harmful to their academic achievement.
Unless you're living in a hood where there are drive-bys going on or something like that. I mean, again, you get into that whole question of violence and how it plays into this, and it seems to me quite significant because it's so absent from the Cuban schools, regardless of how much state control there may be. Here's Nigel, who says, I love today's show. A few years ago, I saw a documentary about Cuba that discussed their educational system and arts programs. They pointed out that Cuba has 95% literacy, which is a lot higher than the U.S. Also, in your study, did you find that the students were happier with the system that they have? If you didn't, I think that would have given you more of an insight in the society in general. Seems to show that, from what I hear from you, America is not the best in everything, in particular, our educational system.
Well, the kids are definitely happy. Whether the adults are so happy is another issue. But the thing I learned from...
They sure look happy on the cover. This is a great picture on the cover.
The kids in schools look good. They have their uniforms. They're well-fed. They are, in general, well-behaved. I mean, there's always some bad behavior. But the kids seem to be in terrific shape. There is a trade-off. I really want to make sure that people understand if you have – I think the real questions about all this are when you have a democratic system that's based on a lot of individual liberty and certainly family control of the kids and kids' lives, the question is, what does it take to have a good education system overall for everybody? I think that's the issue. How much of that are you willing to give up in order, should one give up in order to get kids that really have true access to better social mobility?
And also to give up maybe autonomy and choice.
Not necessarily all.
No, but to give up some of that. You familiar with KIPP schools and Amistad Academy?
I actually was going to raise the issue of the KIPP schools because the KIPP schools are... seem to me, from what I've read about them, I've never been in one, but seem to me to be very much on this model.
Well, here's a listener, in fact, who says, although I haven't read Martin Carnoy's book, it sounds fascinating. I plan to order it as soon as I can to read ASAP. Although KIPP schools and other schools like Amistad Academy get a lot of press, they also receive a fair amount of criticism from teachers' unions, pundits, academics, and people who claim schools like KIPP and Amistad undermine public schools and cream the best students, or at least the students whose parents are more committed to their children's schooling. He pointed out some of the commonalities between Cuban schools and Department of Defense schools. How does what goes on in Cuban schools compared to what goes on in schools such as Kip and Amistad?
Well, I think I've looked at the Kip schools a little bit, not personally, but as with my co-authors in another book. The Kip schools actually have made an effort to recruit the very toughest to teach kids. They have not been all that successful in doing that. They still focus on low-income kids, but it seems from what we saw that they're getting the sort of the better of the low-income kids. They also make the parents sign a contract, and if they don't fulfill that contract, the kids are out. So that in Cuban schools, nobody signs a contract. Your kids have to go to school, and they're going to get the good schooling whether they like it or not, or whether families like it or not. So I think there's some differences. But the idea of a lot of discipline, I think the Cuban schools are actually more child-centered and not so highly on discipline. They get the kids behaving well because they're organized by the pseudo-parent in a very systematic way, and they're taught from the very beginning that there are certain kinds of behaviors. I mean, you know, Japanese schools and Korean schools are similar. You don't have to have a communist society in order to do these things.
Well, it's been a fascinating hour, and I thank you for being with us. Again, Martin Carnoy's book is Cuba's Academic Advantage, Why Students in Cuba Do Better in School, published by Stanford University Press. Appreciate again you being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to extend thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our interns, Lila Rezaki, Christina Shaheen, Katie Stanford, and Clara Liu. Forum's engineer today is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED, much appreciation to your listenership. I'm Michael Kresge.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.